well, I don't care how you've always done it. Is that the right way to do it in 2020?
I'm MK Anderson, and this is First 100 Days. Podcast, where we discuss the idea that if the first 100 days of a presidency are so important, they're likely to be important for anybody else's career and life moves. We'll talk to CEOs, first-time parents, startup bros, and more to discover if the first 100 days are really that important. This episode, we're speaking with Dr. Robert Kustra, President Emeritus of Boise State University, home of the famous blue turf football field. During his 15-year tenure at Boise State, he developed a College of Innovation and Design and a School of Public Service, won multiple bowl football games, and brought doctoral research and PhD programs to the university, amongst other things. I am so excited to learn about the goals he made in his first 100 days as president of Boise State University. Well, thank you so much again for taking the time to chat with us today. How are you?
Just fine, MK. Nice to be with you.
Before we get started talking about your time at Boise State, as the listeners will soon find out that you did so many things before becoming president. So if you wouldn't mind walking us through a quick shot of your resume, because like I mentioned, there could have been so many things we chatted about, but this is just one of the few.
Sure. Well, of course, I had kind of a combination career. I had a career in higher education, but at the same time, I had a career in politics and government. I served as a staff member for the Illinois House of Representatives when I was just out of school, and then I continued pursuing my PhD at the University of Illinois, but after getting it and teaching it for a while, I wound up running for the state legislature, serving in the state legislature for 10 years, 2 years in the Illinois House and 8 years in the Illinois State Senate, serving in the leadership of the Illinois State Senate. And then in 1990, the candidate for governor at the time on the Republican ticket, Jim Edgar, asked me to run with him as his running mate for lieutenant governor, and I agreed to do so. So we ran in 1990, and then we ran again in 1994, and I served two terms. And there was one moment in the middle of that 8 years of service as lieutenant governor when I actually resigned and signed a contract with Disney, which then owned WLS in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be a talk show host.
Amazing.
That lasted for a while, but not too long, because the governor had a quadruple bypass at the same time I was thinking I was leaving state government. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to come back, and I asked ABC Disney to tear up the contract, and I served the rest of my second term with him. And then from there is when I made the big move to higher education. But having said that, I also, during the many years I served in the legislature, 10 years in the legislature, during those years, I was a part-time faculty member teaching in the mornings during the fall at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then I taught at Roosevelt University, and I taught at Loyola University and Northwestern University while I was lieutenant governor. Mm-hmm. So I had all these part-time assignments. I was never a tenured member of the faculty at any of the places I've just mentioned, but with all that experience, it was pretty clear that I had one foot in higher education, mm-hmm. and one foot in politics and government. Mm-hmm. And what really made the transition work for me from politics and government to higher education was a year in my second term as lieutenant governor when the chair of the Illinois Board of Higher Education was killed in an airplane crash in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And someone had to fill that spot. That spot normally went to a layperson, mm-hmm. someone in the business community, for example. That's who the person was who had passed away, Art Korn. And I just went to the governor and said, you know, with all of my background in higher education, I could chair this Illinois Board of Higher Education for you. And he appointed me, and I did that for the rest of my second term as lieutenant governor. And I think it's only fair to say that that kind of set me up for a presidency down in Kentucky at Eastern Kentucky University, because I had not only the teaching experience in the classroom from higher ed, but I had what they would look upon as administrative experience, having chaired the Illinois Board of Higher Education, that I had responsibility for 9 public universities and 50 community colleges in, in that assignment. So that's really the reason why I think Eastern Kentucky University and Boise State University later would look at me as a pretty interesting or attractive candidate. I think if I just went there with nothing more than a political background, I'm not so sure it would have worked for me to make that transition.
Definitely. And I mean, during this time, did you know what it meant to become president of a university? What did that process even look like? Because you have gone through elections, obviously. So you know what it's like to be elected to an office, but this isn't so much of an election as it is kind of a, or at least a closed election in a way.
Well, I served on the Appropriations Committee in the state legislature, in the state Senate, and I watched these presidents come before us every year for their appropriation. And then when I was lieutenant governor, I worked even more closely with the presidents of the universities. I did a reorganization of higher education in the middle of my lieutenant governor years, creating boards of regents for each of the Illinois universities that they did not have before. And I worked very closely with all of the university presidents across the state. So I knew something about the job. I knew individuals who had the job. I suppose what I didn't have or didn't know is the specific experience one only learns when you're on the job, dealing with students, dealing with faculty, dealing with all of the constituencies. Somebody once said that a president has 28 constituencies to which he must report and respond. And I'm not so sure I could count up to 28, but I know it was an awful lot.
Fair.
And there's no question that having that experience working with presidents was a good way for me to kind of get my feet wet early in the game.
For sure. And so with political offices, as you know, you have campaign chairs and policy workers that kind of help you guide you through that process. But what does that look like when it comes to this academic world?
Well, you know, when you're looking for a presidency of a university or a college, you're pretty much on your own. What you do is you first of all, in most cases, especially if you're an incumbent president of a college or university, you're certainly not going to share your interest in moving to another university with the people you're working with or working for. And even if you're, let's say you're, you know, a provost or a dean at a university, you're still not going to want to be broadcasting that you're trying to get out of there and take a presidency of a university. So candidates for a president of a university or a college pretty much work on their own until, in fact, they meet up with the search consultant who is actually doing the work for the university in finding the appropriate candidate for this job. And then the search consultant works with you and really helps you find your way. And that's exactly what happened to me. There's a firm in Chicago called Heidrick & Struggles. I think they're still in business. They were perhaps the very first search firm that decided to carve out a niche area of higher education. And a gentleman by the name of Bill Bowen was perhaps the father of the higher ed search. And he was a supporter of mine in politics over the years. And one day when he heard however he found out that I might be interested in leaving government and going into higher ed, he actually sat down with me, introduced me to a couple of places that were looking for presidents. One of them, by the way, the first one, I went down and interviewed and I didn't get the job.
Okay.
And then along came Eastern Kentucky University, and that turned out successfully. The first one, by the way, was a private college. And given all of my public experience, my political experience in particular, it was pretty clear to me that they didn't want to take any chance on some politician running their university.
Gotcha.
So they passed on that. But in the meantime, when I got to Eastern Kentucky University, it was just the opposite. And it was the same way for Boise State. In both of those searches, I was the most credible candidate because they did, in fact, want somebody who could connect to the funders of the university, to the Appropriations Committee, who could go into the legislature and say, hey, Kentucky legislators, I was one of you back in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, Idaho legislators, I was one of you. I'm a member of your club.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a lot to do with my ability to move into a position like that, since most presidencies of colleges or universities are usually from people who have their entire careers wrapped up in higher education.
Right.
You know, they served as a faculty member, then they served as the chair of a department, then they served as the dean of a college, then they served as a vice president of the college, and eventually they become the president. And I was, I guess, what you would call an out-of-the-box candidate,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that I didn't have the long string of administrative experience, but what I did have is about 28 years of teaching experience in the classroom, so I was able to at least to relate to those members of the search committee who were faculty as perhaps, you know, one of them. He gets us. He spent a lot of time in the classroom. But I definitely had that political experience that was most unusual and still is. There's a few presidents who got to their jobs today,
mm-hmm.
That have the same backgrounds I do. At one point, the state of Florida seemed to be hiring public officials. The Speaker of the House became a president.
Mm-hmm.
The Lieutenant Governor became a president. So there's quite a track record recently,
right,
of politicians who convert to higher education.
So then did you tap back into your political days when coming up with, I mean, I'm sure you kind of know the importance of having a good first impression and coming up with goals right away. Did you tap back into that when building goals for your first 100 days as president of either Eastern Kentucky or Boise State?
Well, you know, the job of a legislator and even a lieutenant governor is really different than that of running a university. So the very
right.
first thing you have to do in a 100-day experience at a university is get to know the territory.
Okay.
And make sure you completely and totally understand where you are. Here I am moving from Chicago, Illinois to Richmond, Kentucky, which might as well be in the middle of Mississippi,
yeah.
in terms of its culture, in terms of its thinking. In those days, you
mm-hmm.
know, maybe they can pride themselves on having advanced significantly in some of these areas. But I would regard Richmond, Kentucky as pretty backward in the days I was there. And that was, of course, 1998 to 2001.
Gotcha.
And in those years, you know, the very first thing you need to do is find out something about, well, where are you really? And I could not have chosen a place more different and distinct from any university or college or place, for that matter, in Illinois. Eastern Kentucky University serves Appalachian Kentucky. It serves Eastern Kentucky, as its name implies.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a region from which it recruits its students, runs all the way to the West Virginia and the Virginia borders on the east. And it's some of the most difficult areas in the country. I don't care whether you want to talk about Oxycontin,
mm-hmm.
whether you want to talk about lack of education, whether you want to talk about the fact that between the mines and the timber companies, they denuded the beautiful land that it once was. It's not all denuded, but they're, you know, shaving the tops off of mountains,
mm-hmm.
So they can mine. And these folks simply, many of them have no good place to work. And at the same time, we're going into these small communities and asking them to give up their kids who were taking care of the tobacco plots that they operated on the side and come to college.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very different cultural experience for me. And so that was the first job. Get to know this place and get out into the mountain communities and listen to people talk about why they either want their kids to go on to college or why they don't, and then
right.
figure out what you're going to do about it.
So then how did that differ between going from Eastern Kentucky to Boise State?
Well, that's really, that's a great question for me in particular, because in my first year at Eastern Kentucky University, I decided that There were three colleges. One was the College of Science and Technology. One was the College of Arts and Humanities. And one was a College of Liberal Arts or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at all these three colleges and I thought, that's the College of Arts and Sciences on any other campus. Mm-hmm. Any place I've ever worked has a College of Arts and Sciences that has, on the one hand, the sciences, the biology and the chemistry and the physics programs, but on the other, it has English and history and art and what have you. And this was all divided up three different ways. And I came in there very confident of all of my political experience, and I'd be able to march into the faculty and tell them, we're getting rid of three colleges and we're reorganizing into the College of Arts and Sciences. Mm-hmm. And I hired a former faculty member. I'm not so sure I hired him, but anyway, he offered to do a survey of his faculty colleagues who he had known over the years and worked with, and he surveyed them all, and he came into me, you know, 6 months after I was in at the university, and said, we're good to go. These faculty, they understand the need for getting rid of these smaller colleges and creating one larger college, the College of Arts and Sciences. So I did it. And I did it rather arbitrarily. I mean, I just one day announced it. And one of the things anybody has to understand about higher education is that it doesn't work like any other organization in the world, in the sense that its culture is such that there's something called shared governance, where faculty and staff seem to think that they have as much to say about the major decisions a university is making as the president who was hired to make them.
Gotcha.
And that's just the way it goes. And frankly, there was a bit of a, I won't call it a revolt, but there was maybe 20 to 25% of the faculty, and certainly the deans who ran these three colleges.
Right.
They didn't like this result. You know, it's like, who's he think he is? He comes in here in 1 year and he pulls something like this off. Well, I did pull it off, and it's in existence today. And I still had, you know, 2/3 or better support from the faculty. I didn't have a vote of no confidence, which is the knee jerk thing faculty usually do when they really have a problem with the president. You know, give them a vote of no confidence.
Yeah.
And those really don't mean a lot. In most cases, the board that you report to usually ignores those. But anyway, I still had great support. But when I moved to Boise State, to get to your question, in the first 10 days, forget the first 100 days,
oh, wow.
I can remember my wife saying, now look, I don't know what plans you have for changing this place, but one thing you better not do is decide you're going to uproot the structure, the infrastructure of the colleges, and why don't we just live with what they have?
Okay.
Well, the good news is, I didn't have to do that anyway because they already had a College of Arts and Sciences.
Right.
They didn't have it broken down three different ways. And there may have been some other things I could have done. But frankly, for the first year, we just spent time really getting to know the place. And I'll tell you, when it comes to the major decisions or those moments, those epiphanies you have when you realize, here's where I'm going with this school. When I was reading the strategic plan of Boise State in 2002 as a candidate, I noticed that they called themselves an urban university.
Interesting.
And I thought, wow, you know, Boise, when I got to Boise, it didn't look urban to me. It looked small city-ish, you know, but it didn't look urban like I knew urban in Chicago or any other large city in America. And so I started giving speeches the first few weeks I was there talking about Boise State, the Metropolitan Research University of Distinction. And I just pulled that out of my hat. You know, it's not like I gave it a great deal of thought, but I thought urban, no, metropolitan may make sense. The city, by the way, was spread all over a valley that has many communities in it. So one could argue that it was metropolitan in nature.
Right.
And the research angle, they were really not. They were a teaching college, a teaching university. And it was very clear that the economy was growing. And people in the economy, especially the tech sector, which was a large part of the Boise's growth, Micron Technology is headquartered here. At the time, Hewlett-Packard had a major presence here with 8,000 to 10,000 employees. They needed a research university. They didn't need a teaching college.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put together this little, you know, Metropolitan Research University of Distinction. And I used it a few times in my speeches, and before you know it, I'd be going downtown to business meetings or wherever I was going, and I'd hear people saying it. It's like, oh my God, I guess they're picking that up from my speeches.
You're a trendsetter.
That became kind of a logo that to this day is the moniker of Boise State. You know, it is the logo that we use. And over the years, what it did is help the various constituencies, from faculty to staff to alumni to the community, better understand who they could become. Idaho is a state that, at the time I arrived, had a major arch rivalry between Boise State University and the University of Idaho, which is 7 hours to the north if you drive it.
Wow.
And there's not much, and there's not very many easy ways to get there by air travel.
Mm-hmm.
So 7 hours away, and yet the University of Idaho had all the clout in the town,
mm-hmm.
and it was regarded by many as Boise's equal, if not its superior, because it was the flagship. You know, it had the name of the state in it,
mm-hmm.
and it was the land-grant university. And so right off, I figured that what we were going to have to do is really focus on that metropolitan label and make sure that people understood that this university, Boise State, must be the city's university.
Mm-hmm.
And no other university or college can compete with the primacy of the Boise State mission as the city's metropolitan university. And over the 15 years I was there, I think we were able to pull that off. And today, there's no doubt in anybody's mind, the University of Idaho still does its thing way up north. But down here in Boise, it doesn't have nearly the presence that it once did. And that's just because the community grew, the city grew, and along with it, the university grew.
Wow. That kind of ties into something I read. You did some interviews, obviously, as you were retiring as president, and you were quoted saying, "I've never been shy about sharing my vision and dreams for this place long before I would know whether or not everybody was going to sign off on them." And do you think that was one of those visions and dreams, or did that just kind of come into fruition as the more you were learning about the people and the place?
Probably a little bit of both, but I think what your question reminds me of is the fact, and I give a lot of I give motivational speeches whenever I'm asked to talk about, you know, how'd you do what you did at Boise State, and it's about risk taking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I did oftentimes speak out publicly before checking in with every last constituency on what was the right thing to do.
Gotcha.
I mean, probably the best example of that, you mentioned it in your introduction. I created this College of Innovation and Design,
mm-hmm.
and frankly, you know, I dreamed that up in my office with one of my vice presidents one day over the summer when we had a little bit more time on our hands to think, as opposed to, you know, running off the meetings all the time.
Right.
And I thought, now, how do I go about doing this? Now, by this time, I had been at Boise State 12 years, let's say, maybe 11 years. And I had a lot of really good relationships in place,
mm-hmm.
and the faculty and the staff trusted me. So I probably had more elbow room to do this without having to check in with a lot of people.
Gotcha.
It did require board approval, but one day I announced we're going to have a College of Innovation and Design. And if there's anybody listening to this that comes from higher education, they'll say, really? You
yeah.
didn't go to the faculty senate? You didn't spend 2 years trying to convince the faculty, and it would normally take that long, that this is something that's good instead of bad? You just did this? The nerve of you, you know? And yet I felt at the time that the only way I would get it off the ground quickly, and the only way we would be able to brand Boise State as an innovative university, which our new president, by the way, I heard her give a speech the other day, and she included in the speech the fact that we have a national reputation for innovation. So we pulled that off. And by the way, 3 months later, the director of the Harvard Innovation Lab
mm-hmm.
met up with me, and he wanted to move out of Harvard.
Oh,
and
wow.
He wanted to come west. and we hired him as the first dean of the College of Innovation and Design, and he still holds that position. And frankly, that's one of the reasons why we're nationally recognized, because Gordon Jones is nationally recognized, and he's got all these great contacts. He's a Stanford grad, and he worked at Harvard. So between the two outposts of very high-level education branding, higher education branding, we were able to pull this off. But again, I'm not one for sitting around and working on strategic plans that take 3 years. Mm-hmm. If you have a good idea, run it up the flagpole. And sometimes you'll win, sometimes you'll probably lose. But I think the bureaucracy of getting something done in higher education is what's held back universities and colleges from keeping up with the changes that are going on in our society, in our workforce, in our science. And again, it's only by that risk-taking that you can move someplace forward, as we were able to pull off. And I had a lot of help in a short time.
So then do you think that those first 100 days that you were there, or that anybody is taking a leadership role, are important? Or do you think that it's something that can be built on as time goes by? Because you mentioned a lot about having that tenure with the other faculty and staff. But do you think that there was any point of just you starting that really set the tone?
I think when I took over that job, I knew full well, especially from my experience at Eastern Kentucky University, that I had to spend as much time learning who Boise State was as I did learning who those mountain people were that Eastern Kentucky University served. And of course, it's a vastly different experience. Boise State, at one time, was the home to 5 or 6 or 7 Fortune 500 companies, and a good number of those were started by entrepreneur types in their garage and became national companies like Albertsons Foods, for example, which is second only to Kroger in the United States of America.
Wow.
Micron Technology, which is one of the largest tech firms in the world, not just in Boise. I could go on, but somehow, for some reason, when I landed in Boise, and this is still true today, I felt that the university, its faculty and its staff, acted differently than any other place I've ever been in higher education. I felt that they were less tied down to tradition. They were not asking or telling me as often as they did at Eastern Kentucky and other places, "Well, we've always done it this way."
Mm-hmm.
That's the answer you always get.
Right.
"Well, we've always done it this way." Well, I don't care how you've always done it. Is that the right way to do it in 2020?
Mm-hmm.
And I think because Boise has this conventional wisdom about it, that it grew up because people were always thinking out of the box, doing things that were never expected to go anywhere, I think that had some impact on the university and its personnel, its faculty and staff as well. And so I feel like I had way more flexibility at Boise State than I would have ever had at any public university in Illinois, mm-hmm. Kentucky, name your state. It was just a freer opportunity to spread your wings and become who you think this university could be.
That's hilarious, because I went to the University of Notre Dame, right, which is so known for tradition and doing things, and I love tradition, so I can't really criticize it too much. But it's funny to hear you say that, because I know if this was something that was said there, I know that there would be a lot of pushback, just because there is that ingrained tradition, and there is that, this is how we've always done it, and this is how we build community and family.
Let me just comment on what you said, MK, because mm-hmm. it's really, really interesting about what your observation of Notre Dame. Here's the question.
Yeah.
So could Notre Dame have changed their field from green to blue?
Oh.
And the answer, of course, is hell no.
Yeah, no.
There's no way in the world that a traditional university of any kind, not just Notre Dame, is going to go to blue. And back in the day, an athletic director walked into the president of Boise State University and said, "Hey, we got to replace the field. It's worn out." It was AstroTurf at the time, and mm-hmm. it was green. what do you think? Let's go to blue. And the president thought at first, I got to know this guy quite well before he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
The president said, well, I don't know about that. And gave it a few more thoughts and said, yeah, let's do it. And that may be a great example of how different the university is. It's also out west, okay? So in the west, people are way more welcoming than in the east, and you notice that as well. So I think that may, in fact, be the best example, even though it's from football, of, you know, how this university was so very different. Now, I'm sorry I got away from your question.
Oh, what not a the problem. I mean, yeah. Notre Dame, we changed to turf field and everyone had an uproar, and it's still color green, you know? Like, people literally bought the wooden seats from the stadium because that's how much it meant to them. So I totally understand.
Yeah.
Did you have any expectations or any goals that you really hoped would be something that you achieved, or your expectations were shifted once you got there?
Yeah, the big one, the huge one that really preoccupied a lot of my thinking and my dreaming, and I really had to do some serious adjusting to get it done, is that I couldn't understand why Boise State couldn't be identified, ranked as a doctoral research university by the Carnegie Foundation, who does this ranking. And early in my years there, I detected significant resistance from faculty and some key administrators who really thought that was impossible. That was beyond our ability. And maybe they even thought it didn't fit in with who we were. And I say were instead of are, because I think they were looking in the rearview mirror instead of looking out the front windshield as to where this university was going and where the community was going. Again, Boise today is, or it was last year, the fastest growing city in the United States.
Wow.
We can't keep up with the growth of this city. And it's not just people, it's companies, it's tech companies. And you could see some of this coming. Mm-hmm. You could see enough of it coming that you knew, or at least we should have known, that the day would come when a PhD in material science engineering was going to be very helpful to tech companies in software engineering, or in the case of Micron, who are out there, you know, working on the next ingredients of our iPhones.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to make sure we created the PhD programs, almost all of them on the STEM side, science, technology, engineering, and math. I did not see any reason to duplicate PhDs in history, English, and whatever that you can get at the University of Idaho or other places around us in the state of Washington or Oregon. But I knew that on the STEM side, we would definitely need to do this ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to move out a couple of administrators who meant well, but weren't on board.
Mm-hmm.
And I hired one of our deans who agreed completely that we needed to move forward and create more graduate programs, more PhDs, more graduate students, and increase our research. And I hired a VP for research that did that part of it, increased the research, give faculty support for getting more grants from the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of Health. The provost who I hired came in and decided, you know, we're going to start ramping up our degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So we created a degree in biomolecular science. We created a number of degrees on the science and engineering side that now, of course, are producing tons of graduates. But back in the day, that was just something that was really like way, way into the future. And there were even people who just didn't get it. There were a couple of times I had difficulty with my board who thought, wait a minute, this guy's moving too fast. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the Boise State's trying to become the University of Idaho, and we can't have that. There's no room for two of them. And it was 7 hours away.
Right.
And so gradually, we were able to get that done, and it's been 4 or 5 years ago now, but probably in 2015 or 16, the Carnegie Foundation granted us doctoral research status. And I think that, more than anything else, is the best example of how you set your sights on something, and then you just go after it year after year after year.
Well, that's a great way to wrap up chatting about all these things. But if you had any lasting words, I know you say you do some motivational speaking, but if you had any lasting words on how to set the tone for your time in a new position, as I don't think there are going to be, you know, any upcoming presidents of universities listening to this, but if you are, you know, what are the things that you would tell them to do to really set the tone and create a good path for yourself for the rest of your career?
Well, I think the most important thing is, as I said earlier, get to know the territory. Go slowly in your first 100 days. Spend a lot of time with faculty. Get them in your office. Go into their offices. Do lots of FaceTime. And I'm not talking about FaceTime on your computer. Mm-hmm. I mean, walk around the campus. Get to know the students. Invite them into your office. Go into where they hang out. Do everything you can to really get to know the place. This new president that we have here at Boise State, Marlene Tromp, that's T-R-O-M-P, by the way, comes to us from the University of California at Santa Cruz. And she's brand new, and she's followed me, who was here for 15 years, which is one of the longer terms a president serves. Mm-hmm. And she was really smart. First thing she does, she decides to tweet daily. Every little thing she's doing. And she's a master at social media. And she really has figured out how to use social media as a brand new president to become familiar, to become friendly with students, with faculty. Students love her for her use of Twitter. And she, you know, dug right into the football program and led the football team out 1 week and worked with led the cheerleaders another week.
Wow.
And so she just did a lot of things that I think really in her first 100 days, she may be better known as a president in those first 100 days than almost any president historically, because, you know, most presidents are hanging out in their offices in meetings with staff.
Mm.
And that's the worst thing you can do. You've got to get out of that office. You've got to get into the community. That's the other thing. The community, I don't care what its size, of course, the larger the city is, the less this may be important. But if you're a small to medium-sized community, that community is waiting to see who you are and whether they're going to like you or not.
Right.
And the sooner you can get out there and have lunch with folks every single day, introducing yourself, telling your story, and giving them a few hints on what your priorities are as the new president, that's what will make a successful university president.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with us today. I know this has been extremely enlightening because I have no idea what goes into all of this, but I know that I've had my own thoughts and opinions about, you know, my own university's president and how things have been running. So it's really fascinating to learn, you know, what you've been thinking about and what all goes into that.
Great. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to this episode of First 100 Days. Original music by Dan Chmielinski, and feel free to tell your friends. Bye, y'all.